welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hi, this is Jessica at Syosset Library Turn the Page podcast, and I have the pleasure of interviewing. Would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Well, hi, Jessica. It's a pleasure to be here. This is Sandra Schoen.
And Sandra, you, among many things, you were, what was your position in the ER of, was it Roosevelt and then St. Luke's Hospital?
Yes, I was the administrator of the emergency department at Roosevelt Hospital. When I was invited to take that position, it was just Roosevelt Hospital. At some point, a couple of years later, the St. Luke's and Roosevelt merged, and it became St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital. However, I was the administrator of the ER at the Roosevelt site, right in the middle of Manhattan.
And what year? Between what years?
Well, I came into that position in the late 70s and was there through some of the 80s. And then I moved on to other things, but I was there during that period of time, actually for 5 years in the ER. And then when the hospitals merged, they asked me to come up to the St. Luke's site, the administrative offices, and become the head of the marketing and public relations for the whole hospital center, since I had done so much with the press in the Roosevelt ER days because of the breaking news stories that happened there.
So one breaking news story, which I know is, I mean, it's forever being talked about, and I know you have many more beyond this, which we can go to, and it is... In the title of you co-wrote a book called "The Night John Lennon Died, So Did John Doe," which is available on Amazon. Who is your co-author? Is
oh, brilliant Louisa Burns Bisogno, my brilliant co-author. And I will just say that in 1989, I wrote a book which was published by St. Martin's Press. That was long, long ago, called Emergency, and it was based on my experiences at the Roosevelt ER. The last chapter I titled The Death of John Lennon, and that last chapter was the jumping-off point for Louisa and me when we decided to write The Night John Lennon Died, So Did John Doe, which was published in 2015. And the So Did the John Doe is the following. When Lennon was brought into our emergency room, in the trauma room next to Mr. Lennon, another gentleman was brought in, nothing nefarious. He was an old guy. He died, and he had no ID on him. So I had to list him as a John Doe. So in talking to Louisa about that particular moment, she said, "Why don't we write a murder mystery about the John Doe and what happened to him?" And, of course, pull through The Night John Lennon Died and the experience of all of us who were impacted by this sad, sad event. And so that's what we decided to do. So everything in the book, The Night John Lennon Died, So Did John Doe, about John Lennon and Yoko and that night and following experiences is accurate because I was there. The John Doe... all of it we made up, and that's how we did it.
So you were on call the night that John Lennon was killed. So did you ever go off duty that in your job? Were you home when you had heard, or were you at work?
Well, part of my responsibility as administrator of the emergency department, part of it was handling the media. And because it was the middle of Manhattan and there were often breaking news stories, it might be a Broadway star who a broken ankle. It might be a policeman who was shot in the line of duty. There were many kinds of situations that drew the media to the hospital. And part of my responsibility was determining what was appropriate, because after all, there's confidentiality, and what was going to go out to the media and how. So I was on 24-hour calls. So during the day, I was in my suits and went into my office and handled paperwork and did other things that were supportive to the doctors, nurses, housekeepers, the ambulance crews. There was a lot going on. However, the page units in those days, that was before the days of what we have now, cell phones and all of the media that's available to us. So my page unit was a heavy square with a clip on it, and all it did was beep. So when I was there, of course, I was paged to the ER or whatever was happening, and I could take care of it during the day, during my hours there. If it was when I was home or in Lincoln Center watching a concert or sleeping or out to dinner with my husband or a friend, the beep, 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 beep. And what I'd need to do is go to a phone, a payphone,
yes,
call in to the hospital operator, and the hospital operator would connect me to the nurse's station. And there I would hear, "Sandra, you got to come back to the hospital. This is happening. The media's here, a camera's here, or this is here." And so that's what I heard beeping the night that John Lennon was murdered. There was a beep, and I called in, and they said, "Please come. The media is already here. The word is out. John Lennon's been shot." At that point, that was the message. So I literally threw on some clothes, and I actually moved to three blocks within the circumference of the hospital when I took this job, because I knew I was going to be on 24-hour call. And one of the funny things is that I used to, during the day, I'd go out in my suits, as I said. When I was called in the middle of the night, sometimes it would be 2 or 3 in the morning, I'd zip out the front door. The doorman never knew what I did. And occasionally, if it involved the police, when whatever I took care of at the hospital with the media and anything else was done, the police men and women, who I got to know very well, would say, "Come on, Sandra, we'll drop you at home. It's only 3 blocks, but it's the middle of the night." And so my doorman would see me coming out of the back of the police car at 2 or 3 in the morning. They never knew what I did, and I never told them.
So you are mysterious.
Indeed, the mysterious woman. So that night, I was called into the hospital because it was already chaos outside the hospital, with camera crews and microphones and people who were already hearing about it, just citizens. And it actually, I know one of the sports announcers who was announcing I think it was a football game, broke into the football game time and mentioned that Lennon was shot and brought to Roosevelt Hospital. So that did it in terms of thousands of people showing up. And it was, of course, an extraordinary time, not the only time that, and of course, the doctors did not realize at the beginning. They do not pay attention when someone comes in whose life they're trying to save. They're not really interested or focused at all on who that person is. So they literally, at the very beginning, did not know it was John Lennon. And by the way, the police brought Lennon in the back of a police car. They did not wait the ambulance those few minutes. The cops got there first to the Dakota. And so they lifted him up, put him in the back of the police car, and drove him to the ER. And one of the policemen literally carried John Lennon into the emergency room over his shoulder, like the firemen do with certain cases that they, you know, that's the way they do it. So he was, of course, put onto a gurney in the trauma room, and immediately there was a team working on him. One of our extraordinary physicians, actually the head, the chief of the emergency department, Dr. Stephen Lynn, did a thoracotomy. He cut Lenin's chest open, put his hand in, and massage his heart as a last effort to try to save him. But there were too many of his blood vessels and other organs that were already compromised, and it was, of course, impossible to save John Lennon.
Unfortunately, yeah. I mean, it certainly, it's interesting, you know, because John Lennon was and still is an international name. You know, he was born in England, and then he became a New Yorker kind of in the time where he sort of, you know, went into like a reflective period and then had just come out with an album, I believe.
Well, he actually that night was coming home with Yoko from a recording session, I believe. And for us, for Dr. Lynn and for me and certainly for others, they were neighbors. We lived in the same neighborhood. I used to see John and Yoko and then Sean in the park, Central Park occasionally, or in one of our local restaurants. So
he was, just, you know, just a New Yorker doing New York things. And were you a Beatles fan?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, when my husband and I got married, the song we asked to be sung and played for us was In My Life.
Which is a beautiful song.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
So, I mean, beyond what happened that night, I mean, so first of all, so the ER was in chaos because, you know, there was this international celebrity there. And then, but at the same time, the rest of the ER was operating as usual?
Well, we always describe the ER as organized chaos. The chaos is built in certain situations, and the emergency rooms are very well organized. Everyone knows what they're supposed to do and does it, and that's why when possible, at all possible, lives get saved, and of course that's extraordinary. So yes, everything else continued as it should, and of course Yoko was actually brought into the ER by a second police car following the first one. And she was in a room where we gave her some privacy. And, of course, Dr. Lynn had to go in and tell her that her husband couldn't be saved. And just breathtakingly sad, of course. And she had asked if we could hold off giving our official statement to the media, to the press, until she got home. She said she didn't want Sean to be seeing this, hearing this on TV.
Of course,
we said we would honor that. So there was a whole process. This was part of my job that night, part of what I was trained to do and knew how to do and had actually done other times for others, but never on this scale. And that is, I chose to have her exit from a different part of the hospital because I was hoping that we could avoid the press taking photos of her leaving the hospital. And she had called a friend to come and be with her, and he was there to help get her home. And so I got the New York City police, who are wonderful, to come. There were a couple of dozen of them to line up out in an area that on the side of the hospital, hoping that we could just keep people away. And in fact, we got her to that door and opened the door, and there was a photographer from one of the New York City papers who flashed a picture. And it was on the front page of the paper the next day, Yoko coming out of that side door, being assisted by her friend.
On one of the worst, or the if not the worst moment of...
Oh.
That's terrible.
So as hard as I tried, I was not able to accomplish that the way I wanted to. And then the other piece was that once someone is deceased in the ER, then there is a process, and of course the family determines whether that body is going to be transferred to wherever. In this mm-hmm. case, because it was a crime, number one, the medical examiner of the city of New York had to come. This was a criminal investigation now, even though the perpetrator had already been arrested. There's a whole process. So I had to wait for the medical examiner. First of all, we had to wake him up. It was no longer December 8th, 1980. It was now December 9th, was in the early morning. And he was very clear. He said, you just keep the body there till I get there and do my thing, and then we will have the vehicle come to take him to the morgue, because there was a whole process that needed to be done because it was a murder. And so that was all part of what happened next. And I waited for the medical examiner, and he did what he needed to do. And then I asked him to sign some papers because he was taking the ER report with him, and that is sacrosanct in emergency rooms. It is the piece of paper where all the information about who the patient is, what belongings he's had, and in this case and in other cases where there's a crime, the doctor had drawn crude pictures of the bullet wound places, crude in the sense that obviously it was not an official photograph or whatever,
right,
indicating where in the body the bullet wounds were. And, of course, two doctors signed that. I was making sure that that was not going to be anywhere where somebody could try to buy it or sell it or whatever. But in the meantime, the medical examiner was certainly entitled to a copy of it, and I asked him to sign for it. I thought, he's going to arrest me or something. You know, I'm asking the medical examiner of New York to sign, and he said to me, good for you. You're following protocol.
Good, yeah.
That's what I like to do. So that was the moment. And then, of course, how are we going to get the body of this man who was alive and living his life and beloved and appreciated by people all over the world out without the media? So there was a whole process we put into place about getting wheeling the body down to an area in the hospital that was a loading zone for when medical supplies and whatever came into the hospital and went out. And that's what I arranged for the morgue van to come and pull in back up so that we could, in fact, quietly, we hoped, and again, the police were there and there were crowds there, but no photographs, thank goodness. The other surprise for me was that I expected there to be that completion. And when one of the morgue van drivers said to me, I have papers for two people, John Lennon and John Doe. And I said, what? And it turned out that, of course, there was another body that needed to be transported. And so I had to quick send some of the security guards back to get to our little hospital morgue, get the other body, bring it up. So literally, in the back of that van, there were two Johns that were taken off.
Oh, wow.
To the morgue. And, and then my day began.
Oh, wow.
Because
before
the media.
Yeah.
Media calls from all over the world, calls from some kooky people. Got a call from a rag, one of these, I guess, rags.
Yeah.
That offering me money for a copy of the ER sheet.
Oh, my God.
I told you what was on that.
Yeah.
I hung up on him twice. He kept calling back. It was. So I was there for most of that following day. And then, of course, prior to that, Dr. Lynn and I talked about what the statement was going to be. We wrote the statement, and, of course, it was Dr. Lynn who gave the statement to the media. And that was, of course, shortly after John Lennon was pronounced, which was at about 11:10 p.m. on December 8th, 1980.
Oh, wow. Since that time, do you think you built protocol out of that moment, because you really had to think very quickly, or do you think, like, was that like mostly like just like the way that the statement is given, was that mostly, you know, just standard as to how things were supposed to go?
Well, no, it was different in each situation for people who were known by the public. So it depended on the situation. There was an interesting, well, there were so many. I'm thinking about which ones that I want to share in public. Well, this is actually a beautiful one. Christopher Reeve, who was an actor. He was Superman in the movies. He lived in New York on the Upper West Side, and he was rehearsing to replace whoever was the original actor in Born on the 4th of July, I think it was, or Born on the 5th of July, I can't remember.
Oh,
exactly.
Yes, Born. Right, I think it was Born on the 4th of July, okay.
Right, and that the main role in that the actor played was in a wheelchair. So he was rehearsing on stage, he was brought into our emergency room with both his elbows fractured. And when I went into the room to see him, because I knew it was going to involve the press, he had asked to see the person who would be involved, because, and this is the story he told me. He said, I forgot to open the lock on the wheelchair when I was going to roll it forward as I was saying some lines, and I pushed ahead and flew out of the wheelchair, and here I am with of my elbows fractured.
Oh.
And he said to me, I've always been accident prone. I can't believe I did this.
Oh, wow.
And, of course, we know that ultimately, years later, he had an accident on horse.
Yes. And
that ultimately led to his being paralyzed and dying. That was the first round I had with him. And he had asked me, he said, please talk to my PR person. I want to put out a statement, because obviously I'm not going to be able to play this role right now.
Right.
So there was a whole process, and that was a whole different thing. And then about a year later, the middle of the afternoon, the clerk from the front waiting room area said, there's a gentleman here, he asked for you by name. So I came out, and there's Christopher Reeve. He was doubled over, and he said, I remembered how wonderful you were last time. I'm in terrible pain. I said, well, you don't need me. You need a doctor. We got him into the ER. He was in the middle of having an appendicitis attack,
In
fact, had to be rushed up to have his appendix removed, and there was a whole other thing. He was about to go off to, I don't remember where, Europe, to do a play and whatever, so I worked with this PR person for what we were putting out at that point.
Oh.
And about 6 months later, I got a note from him at the hospital, in the old-fashioned snail mail, and he said, Dear Sandra, you and your staff have always been so wonderful to me. If there's anything I can ever do for you, please let me know. Well, at that moment, I was in the middle of writing the book, Emergency, that I wrote years ago in 1989. And I called the editor and I said, how would you feel about having a foreword in the book from Superman? And she said, what are you talking about? So I told her, and she said, that would be fabulous. So I called Chris. And I said, this is what I'm writing, whatever, would this be something? Oh, he said, I'd love to do it. I'm just going off to do summer stock. I definitely, I'm going to write something. I'm going to send it to you. Well, that was in June. I didn't hear from him, and I wasn't about to bug him about it.
Right.
And then it was July, and my editor said, listen, Sandra, we're going to have to go to press. We can't wait for this. Call him. And I said, you know, I'm not going to bother him. He knows. And that was always and has always been my style. I'm not, you know, he will or he won't. So she said, well, you better write a foreword. Because we can't wait any longer. We have to go to press. So I did write the foreword, which in the emergency book says, kudos to all of the doctors and nurses and paramedics and important others in the emergency department at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital Center who care all of the time. So that's what's actually in the foreword. And in September, I get a call from Christopher Reeve. Sandra, I'm so sorry. I was busy, whatever. I wrote the foreword. I wrote it. I had it. And I said, oh, Chris, that's wonderful, but it's too late. So he sent me a copy of what he would have had in the book, which I have somewhere in my files. And that's the story of Chris Reeve, who was a wonderful, extraordinary, loving kind of person who had a tragic accident that led to his death ultimately.
Yeah, that's actually quite incredible. And for the longest time, and even still, Christopher Reeve's name is synonymous with Superman. I mean, so many people have played Superman since. But when people think of the actor who is Superman, he's definitely the one people think of.
Yes. Very nice man. He and his wife both. And
I just wanted to talk. So the emergency book, it talks a little bit about how and there's obviously things woven into it. And the night John Lennon died, so did John Doe. About how you got into your position, and you talk a little bit about a ride along you did.
Well, that was with the paramedics. When I was first on staff in the ER, I set up meetings for each of the three shifts, 8 to 4, 4 to midnight, and midnight to 8, for all of the people who worked in the ER during a given shift, because I felt it was important to find out from them what worked and what they needed, because we were there to serve the public. And in order to do that, in a setting, even though the chaos was organized chaos, it still was very stressful many times. And even when it wasn't stressful, it was important that the people that worked there had what they needed to do the best they could do. We all know how that feels, to have the resources we need to do our job as well as we want to. So when I sat at these meetings and I invited not only the doctors and the nurses, but the housekeepers who mopped up the blood, the clerks who had people coming up to them saying, so how's my family member doing and how long is it going to take? And the paramedics and the EMTs who would go out on the ambulances. And what the EMTs and paramedics told me was, and remember, this was in the late 70s, we don't have the proper equipment. Literally, they had old-fashioned walkie-talkies, but when they'd go out on a call occasionally, they'd be going to perhaps a tenement house where they'd walk up five flights of stairs and into an apartment that maybe had no lights on and they didn't know what was happening, what was going on. So they said, we need more sophisticated equipment. We need this, we need that. And I said, well, how about I go out with you on a few of the calls on the different shifts and see what it's like and what you need. And that's what I did. So it was pretty amazing to go out with these men. It was mostly men. At that point, actually, as I recall, it was all male, and that has changed considerably, which is a good thing, because women can do the job just as well, of course, and do. And so I saw what they did, what they needed, what worked, and what could be supported and helped, and then I took care of it. So into my budget went some more sophisticated equipment, and that they could also connect. Remember, again, no cell phones, whatever. So connect with the police, who sometimes were the first on a scene where there was then needed an ambulance, EMTs, paramedics. So that was an interesting experience, and they were very grateful for that.
I think there's definitely something to be said that you want to make sure that, you know, an administrator knows just what everybody, you know, what everybody goes through.
Well, I was a bit of a maverick, and certainly the first time I let people know there was going to be a once-a-month meeting in the midnight day shift, which of course meant I would come back into the hospital for that once time that wasn't involved with being paged in for a breaking news story. And at the beginning, and that was when I first took the job, after the first few months, they were a couple of them were a little suspicious, like, what's the boss doing coming in to spy on us in the middle of the night? But what I knew was that nobody really paid much attention to what they did, and maybe there were some things they needed help and support with, as well as hearing from them what was going on and what they needed. Once the second meeting had happened, and clearly they had lots to say, I would get notes. When's the next meeting? I have something I want to talk about. So that was really wonderful.
So before, and there's so many stories from both emergency and also things interwoven into the night John Lennon died, so did John Doe, that I'd love to follow up on. And I'd like to invite you back to talk about it, because I feel like, you know, you have so much knowledge and, you know, you're such a great speaker. But to close out this particular episode, I wanted to ask you, you had some stories about Marathon Day, and that's something that's coming up. So that could be, or I think maybe would have happened by the time this airs. But would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes. Marathon Day in New York City is coming up, I believe, the first Sunday in November, which is in just which of course happens every year in the fall. And when I was in the ER, the Marathon Day in New York City used to happen on the second Sunday in October, and that was a day when, even though it was a Sunday, I was there all day. Why? Because in the old days, quote unquote, the system that the marathon executives had was very limited. People would get a number and they'd wear it across their chest, but they didn't have the more sophisticated system that's been in place now for many years, where people actually registered and their name and other information and a contact person is all available now and connected to that system. And the runners run through all five boroughs, and the end, the finish line, is at the end, is on Central Park West, which is literally blocks from where the Roosevelt Hospital was located, and so the ambulances were sitting there from Roosevelt because we knew there were going to be people who made it across the finish line and collapsed, or collapsed before the finish line, and the EMTs would go in and put them on a gurney and bring them into the ER. What was my job? First of all, weeks before, I would order giant rolls of aluminum foil. Why, you may ask? Because sometimes runners were brought in with temperatures that were so high they were life-threatening, and they would be plopped on a gurney. We would throw ice on them, literally, ice cubes, mounds and mounds of ice cubes, and wrap them in the aluminum foil to bring their temperature down as quickly as possible before the doctor could actually treat them with more sophisticated methods. So that's where I was. Dr. Lynn and I talked about the fact that many Octobers in the middle of the month are still hot weather,
yep,
as in fact was true this year in New York. So there were some of the staff who went and talked to the gentleman who ran the New York City Marathon and convinced him to move it from October to where it is now, November, where there's more certainty that there will be cooler weather. And a marathon day, my other job in the ER was that because people were brought in sometimes from other countries, if it was they spoke only French or Italian or Spanish, there was certainly someone on staff, if not in the ER in the hospital, who could come and translate. Because what I wanted to know is, do you have someone who was waiting for you? Is there someone I can call to bring in to be with you that you had with you? None of which we knew in the early days. However, occasionally there was someone that spoke a language, only a language that none of us understood. Some of the Mandarin languages. And so what I used to do, I had this whole list pre-prepared, and I would call, for instance, in the case of the Mandarin, I would call a Chinese restaurant and see if one of the cooks in the kitchen spoke Mandarin. And then I would put that cook on the phone with the patient, whose temperature had now been brought down but was still in bad shape, and have them translate. Ask, does he have anyone waiting for him? And then I would take the phone back. Yes, his brother was with him, but he doesn't know where his brother. But what's his brother's name? That was what I did. That was the other part of the job that I created and developed for myself in those early days of the marathon day in New York City.
That's incredible. Sandra, thank you so much for chatting with us. I really am going to give you an open invitation to come back.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. And yes, the night John Lennon died, so did John Doe, is a reflection definitely of an important part of how I was able to contribute in the emergency room. And I so honor all people who work in emergency departments. They're a very, very special breed whom I honor every day.
Absolutely. And, you know, we owe our lives to them, really. You know, when the unthinkable happens, they're the ones who are there. So
lucky us.
Lucky. Yeah, exactly. Lucky us. Well, once again, Sandra, thank you so much. The Night John Lennon Died, So Did John Doe is available on Amazon, also in audiobook. Is that correct?
Yes.
And I am going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
Thank you, Jessica. It was a pleasure being with you.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.